The math that you're going to hear from me is third grade math, probably. So here we are. It's the name of the piece. You just click once, is that it? Oops, sorry. No relationships, as we've all heard from other. Actually, you were the only person I've heard for this entire time. All of these presentations you've had said yes, you had relationships, but I have none to disclose at all. So two things that are just I want you to keep in mind for background as we're going through this. The first one is, and this is something I'll talk about this in more detail, that I'm going to be talking about funding men's health initiatives and putting money into men's health. We are not trying to take funding away from women in order to fund men's health. It is a completely separate issue. And the other one is, very important also, I'm going to a lot of numbers, but that we're only talking about the excess cost, which is just the difference between what's essentially the difference to get men as healthy as women are, not to get men completely healthy and live women where they are. There are plenty of, we have a long way to go to get everybody healthy. So we all know this. I mean, you've been involved in medicine and healthcare. You probably know these things, but just to give it a little bit of context, men have higher death rates, no question about it, from 9 of the top 10 killers. It used to be all 10, but Alzheimer's has kind of snuck in there recently, and so women are dying in greater numbers of that, but men still have 9 out of the top 10. And just, you can see in 1900 or so, the difference in lifespan was about 1 year. It kind of peaked in about the 70s and 80s at about 7, and it's leveled off pretty much to about 5 years. So 5 years shorter and less healthy lives that men have. So this is something I think we can generally agree on, that every year, hundreds of thousands of guys are dying prematurely, unnecessary deaths. And I've been writing about this stuff for, as Garland said, for about 15 years or so. And continually come back to this and the lifespan and the various sicknesses that men have and illnesses that men have. And the response generally is, nobody really cares. There's the social justice argument, which is we need to be doing something to take care of these lives. But the social justice argument, I can tell you after years of kind of pushing that, does not seem to impress a lot of people. So the approach that I'm taking here is, okay, if the social justice thing doesn't work for you, let's talk about how much money this costs us. And it is a ton of money. And we're talking broadly about direct payments that are made by the federal government and also lost income by the federal government, not including in this particular presentation, state and local too terribly much, lost productivity to U.S. businesses and to the economy, and also direct costs, medical costs and other costs that are incurred by the economy. And it's a total of, and this is a very, very conservative number, as you'll see as I go through this, somewhere between $480 and $550 billion, roughly, which is that's a ton of money, frankly, that we could have back in our economy. So going through it a little bit at a time, hello, start off with the uninsured. Men are, I'm skipping ahead here. So since about 2006, men's share of the unemployment, and they have always been more unemployed than women, has grown from about 54% to 64%. That's a fairly significant number of compared to women. That's a fairly significant number. So what happens is you don't have a job, you tend to live a less healthy life. There have been all sorts of research on the fact that people who don't have jobs are more likely to be diabetic, to have high blood pressure, heart disease, depression, alcohol, substance abuse. It's not a good thing. You continue on with that, you don't have a job, you generally don't have insurance. It would be exactly the opposite effect of what you were talking about. And so just to give you a sense of what these look like, in the 18 to 64 age group, about 55% of the uninsured are men, and in the 18 to 34 age group, like a little bit more of a prime working years, it's 57% are men. So if you don't have insurance, again, you get into the health issues. The American Cancer Society has said that people who don't have insurance are much more likely to die of cancer than people who do have insurance because they wait till the very last second to go to the emergency room. They just aren't getting the kind of care that they need. So people are dying as a direct result of this. The Institute of Medicine puts a hard dollar figure on caring for the uninsured at about $30 billion a year. And that's just the hard cost. But they say, and I think it's a very interesting thing, and it's a very important thing, that the larger costs are not the money that's going out necessarily, but the cost to society of people not taking care of themselves. And so you have the $30 billion in compensation to hospitals who are not being compensated for taking care of the uninsured. And so the number that we come up with is somewhere between $65 billion and $130 billion. So that's the Institute of Medicine numbers. And so where I got the 6.5 and 13 was taking the difference between the 55%, right, 55% and 45% of unemployed men, unemployed women, just taking that 10%, and so we end up with 10% of the Institute of Medicine's numbers of 65, we get down to 6.5. So the next issue is tax revenues. If you're not working, you're not going to be earning any money, you're not going to be bringing in any taxes. For the 25 to 64 age group, which is the prime working years, there are 1.4 million more women than men in that age group, just in this country. So what we did is we looked at that, and we took kind of averages looking at Census Bureau numbers and Department of Labor numbers. And so we take the 1.4 million extra women, and we say, you know, we'll say that there should be 1.4 million men. We'll take about 80% of those would be in the workplace, and they would be earning roughly, these are according to Department of Labor and CDC numbers, they'd be earning about $50,000 a year. And so the result of that in taxes, if you use kind of the average accepted tax number of 9.2%, you'd end up with about $5 billion in lost income tax revenue that the federal government's not getting. And then when you add in the employer portion of this stuff, the other little lines that you get from that's not coming off of your paycheck, it's coming out of the employer's pool, another $4.2 billion. So we're up to $9.2 billion just in lost tax revenues. Then we're kind of moving on to disability issues. Because men are losing or living sicker lives, they tend to be much more disabled, and they tend to receive the vast majority of Social Security disability payments. They're going to men. And there are, as this slide is saying, it's 412,000 more men than women are receiving disability benefits. Looking at that as an average of $1,100 a month, you end up with $5.9 billion. And that's in direct payments that would not have happened had men, again, kind of going back to that theme, had men been as healthy as women. Then there's the other side of that, which is the survivor's benefits. There are, at age 65, for every 100 women, there are 135, I'm sorry, every 100 men, there are 135 women. So that's a pretty big gap. And what happens is that elderly women are generally not poor when they're married, and they become impoverished after their husband dies. The family income goes from about $23,000 a year down to $11,000. And 20% of elderly widows are living in poverty, and which is five times the rate for elderly married women. So there's a lot that's going on that is a direct result of the husband not being there. And then there are also the intangible costs, which is a really frightening statistic I hadn't heard about until I started looking at this, which is that in the first month after the death of a husband, and I think this works the other way as well, but in the first month after the death of the husband, the wife's risk of dying is double. And so that, is that a question?
Is that usually affected by cultural and what might be changing a woman being more active in the workforce? Could that be changing?
I'm not sure.
I mean, in the past, women have necessarily generally been at home, and then like stay-at-home moms, whereas men just been working. Is it possible that since women are becoming more active in the workforce, that these numbers might change?
It's possible. Yeah, I mean that's something, but that's going to not be hitting us for 20 years or so until you're ready to retire. More than 20 years, we'll say. And it was not looking also, by the way, at the differences between black men's health and white men's health, which is another frightening thing. I mean, black men are much more, twice as likely to die of pretty much everything as white men, but we're just looking at generally men across the board. And so the total cost, Social Security survivor benefits that are going to widows, and again, this is looking at just the part that is directly attributable to the husband not being there, $65 billion a year. Sounds like real money to me. So there are also another, and I kind of paired this way back, thinking I only had 20 minutes, so I can speak a little bit more slowly about this, but the supplemental Social Security is another area where there are direct payments to women, again, because the husband not being there, $6.5 billion. The dual eligible thing is interesting because there are people who are getting, you probably know this better than I do, There's Medicaid, and then there's Medicare, and then there's Medicaid. The Medicaid kind of picks up where Medicare leaves off, and there are a number of people who are dual eligible, and the dual eligibility is something, again, with the husband not being there, another almost $50 billion for that, and then in food stamps, which is now called the SNAP program, it's another 1.2. And that is all, again, the husband's premature death. So just taking a brief summary of the whole thing when it's going, just talking about the government expenditures. So there it is. You've got, again, the uninsured at 6.5 to 13, the tax revenues, Social Security, SNAP program, Medicaid. You end up with the 142 to 148 billion. And that, as big a number as it is, really kind of pales in comparison to what's coming next, which is the cost to business and society. This was a statistic and a concept that I had a little bit of difficulty dealing with, trying to put a value on a year of human life, and that there are ways of calculating this, and there are some accepted numbers. Basically, when these numbers are calculated, it's the difference between somebody dying, say, at 62 and his life expectancy should have been 75, so we end up with 13 years of lost life, lost potential life. And so when you add all these things up, just looking at the CDC numbers, about 9.2 million years per year of male life are lost, potential life lost, compared to about 5.5 for women. So you end up with about 3.6 million missing years of male life because of shorter life expectancies. And this, it would be a lot more if we had men at 80 years of life expectancy, where women are only talking about 75 years. So looking at $50,000 per year, the general statistics, the general accepted numbers for this are somewhere between 95,000 and 297,000. So I figured, I don't want anybody to argue with me about this, I'm going to take half of the lowest number. So you can imagine we could be adding, could be doubling the number that's going to be coming next. So $180 billion. We could easily, again, get to 350, or if we went five times the number, we could be significantly more than that. So it's also a pretty healthy number. Talked a lot so far about what happens with death, and these people are gone completely. But there's also the fact that a lot of people are hanging on. They're living, they're living less productive lives because they're sick. They're not there completely. Their productivity's gone. They're taking a lot of time off to be heading off to the doctor, and so we end up kind of looking at lost productivity numbers. And there's the Milken Institute and there's the Department of Labor, and they both have looked at this. The Milken Institute looked at just seven chronic conditions, and we have a situation in this country where about half the population is suffering from some sort of a chronic condition at any given time. So the Milken Institute looks at it, and they looked at these seven: cancer, heart disease, hypertension, mental disorders, diabetes, pulmonary conditions, and stroke, which are certainly the big ones. But just looking at those, they've put it at about $1.3 trillion a year in lost productivity. And they're saying about $300 million is hard costs, and about $1 billion is a little bit more abstract, but it is certainly measurable in terms of lost productivity. The Department of Labor looks at it a little bit more broadly, taking all the causes, and not just those seven that the Milken Institute is looking at, and they came up with 1.8. So what we did was, to calculate this number, 56% of the workforce is male, 44% of the workforce is female. These are full-time workers. It's much closer if you just measure just stroke tallies for who's in the workforce. But so there's a difference of 12%, 12 percentage points. So taking those 12, these numbers times the 12 percentage points, or Milken's numbers and the labor numbers times the 12 percentage points, and you end up with that 156 to 216 billion per year. So here's what we've got: the 150 roughly for the government, the 180 in terms of lost productivity, and somewhere around 100, up to 200 in economic costs. And that's the number that I started off with, 479 to 546. And again, I keep hammering at this mostly because it's sort of a self-defense, because I keep hearing this. This is just what it costs to get men as healthy as women, not to get them healthier than women. Women, and again, we have a long way to go to get women's health where it needs to be, but if we can get men just as healthy as women, we're talking about pumping, call it $500 billion a year into the economy, which could do a lot of good stuff with that. So there's another argument to this, or another way of looking at it, which is, okay, so you want to save money, you want to educate people about their health, it's not going to be free. So we've got to figure out exactly where this money comes from, kind of getting back to the taking away from women. And there is a consensus. The numbers are a little bit hard to come by, but there are some statistics about the return on investment for health promotion programs. But the general consensus of all of them that I've looked at is it produces positive returns. So a lot of the returns are intangible, such as reduced, better, Dr. Bethea, you probably remember some of the benefits that you were talking about yesterday of the programs you're involved in, with people getting more involved, that people...
Yeah.
All intangible, but they're very good, but you can't put a dollar, but you aren't putting a dollar on those yet. So just looking at it for just businesses, and I'll get into the government side of things in just a second, just looking at the businesses, there were a couple of big studies that were done by Dow Chemical and Citibank, and they both looked at how much money they put into health promotion and health fairs and things like that, health education, and how much money did they save. Citibank saved $4.56 roughly to $4.73 for every dollar they put in. That was the return that they felt that they got, close to $5. Dow Chemical was a little lower, $3.21 per dollar invested. And that's, you get your dollar back plus that. So that's a pretty fair number to say, okay, you look, this is really worth something. We're getting something out of this. Then there was a study that was done kind of more broadly. It was done by the National Business Group, and they took 325 companies that employ 1,000 or more employees, and they looked at health promotion, the money that they put into health promotion and health education, and they found that these companies had higher revenue per employee by 11% compared to companies that did not, the same size, that did not have the health benefits, 11% higher, 25% lower medical costs, fewer absentee days. They had, and this is the one that certainly will hit people, is 28%, higher shareholder return, again, compared to companies across the board that did not have the health benefits, and there's less turnover. Turnover, for those of you who have something to do with the HR field, is a massive number. Generally, they talk about a year and a half salary to retrain somebody. So companies that are reducing turnover are saving big bucks on that. So there we are. Those are the numbers, the other benefits we talked about just a second ago. Now let's look at kind of what's going on with the government, because a lot of these programs, the educational programs, are going to have to be coming from the government. Again, not a huge amount, because there are not so many men's health programs. But I won't talk about two of them, but just kind of looking at broad health. So there was a program in Baltimore called the Baltimore City Men's Health Group. They offered no-cost screenings and prevention and treatment for men who were coming in. And they had more intangible results. They basically were talking about reducing ER visits and reducing rehab costs and things along those lines. Then there was one in Denver, which was the Denver Men's Health Initiative, which was similar. They had low-cost or no-cost services for men. And they found they actually were able to put a dollar on. They found that they had an increase in primary care visits, which was interesting. But that increase was way offset by a huge decrease in urgent care and in behavioral health issues or visits. And there were also a dramatic decrease in the uncompensated charges that they got, which was another surprise that they had. And so even after every single cost, and they were talking about adding up medical supplies and even the cost of transporting patients from place to place, they ended up saving $3.61 for every dollar they spent on this thing. And then there was, to kind of put it into to see what happens on a more national scale, there's the Trust for America's Health, and they were looking at, if we spend $10 on health education, what do you get back? So they felt you spend $10 per person on health education nationwide, you would have a return of $2 billion per year savings within the first year or two. And that's, again, $2 billion plus what you pay. So you get your money back to get you to zero, then you move on to $2 billion savings a year within the first 2 years, up to $16 billion a year in years 5 to 10, and in years 20 or 10 and beyond, you're talking about saving $18 billion a year. So that's where those numbers are. And then there's also this concept, I was about to skip that, about externalities, which is something, there was one of the co-authors on here who did a lot of the research, a guy named Mugaleta Tedele. This will be a lesson to you not to ignore taxi drivers. our executive director, I do a lot of work with Men's Health, my brother standing right back there, takes taxis a lot, and he asks people, hey, how long have you been driving, and what do you do? So he's driving in a taxi, and he meets this guy, whose name is Muguleta, and turns out the Muguleta was an economics major at Johns Hopkins, and figured, well, this is a guy to put to work doing some statistics, and he came up with some of the numbers that were in here. And he also introduced me to this concept of externalities, which is that it's another intangible kind of a cost, but when you do something to help with one area, and for example with men's health, one example of an externality and intangible cost is if men are healthier, their wives don't have to take off from work to take care of them. And this is not a number that I was even considering in these calculations, but it's a huge number with women having to take off in the middle of the day, the lost productivity that comes with that could be added back into this, but that's an example of an externality that came here. So as far as conclusions, and this is probably where I differ in the traditional academic way of structuring a paper, because I'm going to not tell you all the various things that went wrong, but these are the things I think we ought to do. A number that will probably surprise you is that women outnumber men in research right now. There, no question, didn't used to be that way. Women had a perfectly legitimate gripe that there were more women more men in research projects than men. Now it is absolutely switched. And from 1995 to 2008, every year women have outnumbered men, and anywhere from 51% to about 65%. And looking at the NIH projections for what they're going to be spending on just there, and this is just the NIH budget, there's not the CDC and all the other ones, they're going to be spending $3.72 billion on women's health. And that includes $778 million for breast cancer and another almost $100 million for cervical cancer. And let's compare this to the money that goes to prostate cancer, less than half, despite the fact that roughly the same number of men die of prostate cancer as women die of breast cancer. And you know, if you want to kind of see this, I find it very frustrating to see these kinds of things, but just going to the exhibit hall, there's the HRSA booth, and they have a new website that they're putting up, healthygirls.gov, I think is what it is, and they're talking about, wouldn't it be wonderful if we had a world without health disparities and women's, it's a complete focus on women's health. There's not a mention of boys or men in there, and this is a federal agency that is not supposed to be picking sides. The last thing that I want to leave you with is to consider what we've been working on for a number of years, to create an Office of Men's Health. And it sounds like such a simple thing. In the federal government, there are at least eight offices of men's health in pretty much every branch of the federal government, every branch of the military. And there are huge budgets. I mean, you just saw how much is being spent just by NIH. There are exactly that many offices of men's health in any federal government agency. There's some talk about an agency that's going to be dealing with Indian men's health, but that is offset by an agency that's dealing with Indian women's health, but that has no budget. And as far as just looking at state governments, the states are not a whole lot better. I think there are about 17 states at least, the ones that I could find in a fairly cursory look at this. I wasn't trying to come up with hard numbers for this, but at least 17 have offices of women's health. There are none that have significant offices of men's health. And again, not trying to take anything away from women. I'm trying demonstrating that money that we put into funding men's health is going to produce some significant results. And I think that women, again, have been absolutely the model that men need to look at as far as not letting people push you around, basically. I mean, women have done a fantastic job of advocating for their own health. And men have not done that, and I think it's wonderful that there are so many women in here, which is, I think, what's going to have to happen is a lot of women are going to be pushing this, and perhaps it will be taken a little bit more seriously than it has been when it's done by men. And there's a colleague of ours who works with the Men's Health Network, Jean Bonhomme, and he talks about the rising tide lifts all boats, which is something you hear in other contexts, but just think about it in terms of the healthcare and the discussions we're having now. When men are healthier, everybody's healthier. Kids are healthier, their wives are healthier. It really does, first of all, pumps back another $500 billion into the economy, but people generally will live longer, have healthier lives in a variety of ways. So that's everything I have for you. If you have questions, I put on most of the chairs a copy of the article that this is based on. And if you didn't get one, I've got some more hard copies of it. You can reach the Men's Health Network at menshealthnetwork.org. And if you wanted to get this paper online, it's the Journal of Men's Health at sagepub.com. But you can get the online version if you don't want to schlep back hard copies. But any questions?
It's more of a comment, really. I'm not persuaded of the need for offices of men's health, but what I do think might be interesting would be to take and the offices of women's health that currently exist and build the other gender into that, and particularly if there are externalities between how men take care of themselves or don't on women, we've got to do this as an integrated effort rather than spinning off another set of agencies. That's my first thought.
So I'm going to argue with you about that. There are a number of problems with that. First of all, it puts men in a secondary position, and it says that men's health is a women's health issue. And it may be in some way, but I think that we need... Right, well, that's farther down the road. I think that the reason why to have an office of women's health and an office of men's health is because you can't appeal to the same groups, to two different groups in the same way. I mean, you were talking about this yesterday. You need to have some very specific ways of dealing with men and very specific ways of dealing with women. I mean, just an example from a lot of my work is in fatherhood, just looking at men showing up for parent-teacher conferences. When a kid comes home with a note pinned to his shirt saying there's a PTA meeting on Tuesday, if the dad sees it at all, he hands it to the mom. That's a mom thing. But if a guy makes a phone call and says, Bob, you know, we're having a PTA meeting Tuesday, get your butt down here, he's going to go. It requires a different approach. And, you know, advertising, I do a lot of work with in advertising, and we're working with companies a little bit on crafting their message so they can appeal to men more. You can't sell something to men in the same way that you sell something to women. So if you tell men you want to get some really great resources and really wonderful support about your health, go check out the Office of Women's Health, they're not going to show up. It's not going to happen.
But you see, you're arguing for something that I'm not proposing. I'm proposing an Office of Health where the efforts with respect to women and men are integrated. They can be different,
right?
But that they speak to each other within a common organizational framework. That's what I'm arguing. And you're a lot more experienced in this issue than I, so I'm telling you a first intuition. But I think we need to look for more opportunities to work together rather than separate silos. That's all I'm saying.
I think you're probably right. It could be under, at some future date, an Office of Health, and then but there would need to be two branches.
I think differentiated work makes
yeah.
sense.
We're past the third row. Okay, yeah, in the with the jazz beard.
So you talk about how you approach this from a social justice model.
Yes.
And now from a economic and cost model.
Right.
With that in mind, there's an increasing number of businesses that are restricting their health insurance benefits based on health risk factors, and so they're actually disabling health insurance for people who require health insurance to get access to care. Out of an issue to save costs. The question I have, though, is that when we go from a public or social justice model to a cost model, there are certain perils in there because you start taking and looking at the lens of financial as opposed to quality. Given that you've looked at it from both sides, would you mind discussing a little bit about which one would have more of an advantageous effect by actually leading to improvement in men's health outcomes and men's health status? Is it appropriate to look at it financially?
I think it's essential to look at financial. I'm not going to give up on the social justice thing, but after 15 years of headbanging and getting no real push through on that, kind of looking at, say, you know, kind of what I said in the very beginning. Look, if the social justice thing doesn't work for you, let's talk about money. I would say it needs to be done as a social justice issue, but we need to get to it financially, because I think companies that are cutting benefits need to be told, if you cut benefits, you're going to have problems. If you just spend a couple of extra bucks on this thing, you're going to end up with people who are not going to overutilize the healthcare system. They're not going to, you know, especially companies that are self-insured, they are not going to take you down with overusing, you know, going to the doctor in the middle of the day if they're getting educated and they're getting the kind of support that they need. So I would say that the two of them are tied. In my mind, the social justice kind of takes a little bit of a back seat, but you know, the whole financial thing is really to finance the social justice one. Yeah.
I mean, if I could just put you back on that,
that just working in healthcare over the years, it's gone from a service model to a business model. And you can't really operate efficiently a service model underneath a business model. But it is what it is. So if you don't hit on where the money is, then they're never going to listen to the issues that you're bringing forth. So I think bringing it from a financial perspective is the way that you're going to get people's attention. Because that's why women's health is so big. Because women generate a lot of money in the medical industry. And so if you have people that access your care, i.e. women, then you're going to have offices of women's health. You're going to have 8 of them. And none for men, because men aren't going to the doctors because you guys never get sick. I mean, you know, it's just that simple. So you have to have not only a financial point, but you have to have a center just for people to advocate for men until we get to the same level as women, and then we're able to then have an office of health. But if you're jumping, like yesterday we were at the NPS shop and looking at the health of kids, of mothers, if the dad is involved, then the mom is healthier. So that's how they got their funding. Because we're still working on women's health, but you're negating the whole point of the dad, because that should be your focus, not just that it's affecting this other person. So.
Yeah, on that one, I remember, I think I asked the question yesterday about this, is because it's being funneled through, even the Title X stuff is kind of being funneled through women's health. That, yes, having dads more involved helps women's health, but it also helps the dad's health. And you end, because when dads are more involved with their kids' lives, they tend not to run red lights, and they tend to stop smoking, and they generally live healthier lives because they know that they have responsibilities. And they're less stressed, and so you end up with a lot of very positive things just by the being involved as a dad.
We have one more time for one more question.
Yes. Yeah, it's a very interesting question, because on one hand, I'm kind of tempted to say, go along with this gentleman here and say, we just need an office of health, and that would just take care of everybody. But in addition to the fatherhood work, I do a lot of co-writing projects, and I was working on a project earlier this year with a couple of women in New York who are diversity experts, and they were talking about, their idea basically is, this whole notion in the workplace that we need to treat everybody the same does not work. That's kind of what diversity training is all about, is treat everybody the same. Ain't going to happen. And if you do that, you're going to have people who are going to be leaving because they're not appreciated. And you're going to have people who fire people because they didn't think that this one really was doing anything. But, you know, cultural things. So I think we need to, as much as we possibly can without going completely nuts, is divide things up. And we really need to, kind of on a global level, look at everybody who needs help. I mean, just again, sort of touched on this very briefly, within the men's health field, black men, they need a lot more than I do. I work out. But you know, it's not only that. So I think there have to be efforts that are targeting specific groups. I think what I am trying not to do in this whole thing is pit one group against the other. That if we can somehow move everybody forward at the same time with the rising tide thing, because you know it makes a big difference. I mean, if you start, you mentioned black men and inner city issues. I mean, just looking, kind of looping back, a lot of those guys are not involved as fathers because they don't have enough money to buy milk for their kids. The shame issue is huge. So if you bump up a little bit just in that area, if you give these guys some dignity, as you said, they start becoming better fathers. And when they're better fathers, they start taking care of their kids more. And they start telling their kids, you know, this business about you have to go out and beat the crap out of somebody to be a man? No. And you know, big boys don't cry? Well, let's know. You know, if you got a problem, go to the... So it ends up touching every single thing. It's a sufficiently nebulous answer, I think. But yeah. Anyway, thank you very much. If you have other questions, I don't know how to tell you how to get a hold of me. Armin, A-R-M-I-N, at MrDad.com, or you could send something through the Men's Health Network site. There's a contact link, and we'd be glad to answer more questions. Thank you.